Elder Richard P. Lindsay is a native of Taylorsville, Utah. He was sustained as a member of the Second Quorum of 70 on April 1st of 1989. His current assignment includes that of a counselor in the Utah North area of the church and as assistant executive director of the historical department. Prior to his call as a general authority, Elder Lindsay served the church for more than 11 years as managing director of the Special Affairs Department, Government and Community Relations. And during the last 6 years of that period, he was given the additional responsibility of managing director of the Public Communications Department of the church. He indeed has broad shoulders to carry such a big responsibility. In that role, he acted as the principal media spokesman of the church. During the same period, or during that period and earlier, he served as a bishop and a stake president. Elder Lindsay is a graduate of Denver University, and by continuing to take classes at night, he earned a master's and PhD degree in political science and management from the University of Utah. He holds an honorary doctor of human letters from the Salt Lake Community College in Salt Lake. He has been in an administrative capacity for the Bureau of Community Development at the University of Utah, the Utah State Department of Social Services, Utah Council on Criminal Justice Administration, and the state's juvenile court system. He is the author of numerous articles published in professional journals and news publications. Elder Lindsay is a World War II U.S. Navy veteran, and he served in the Swiss-Austrian mission just after World War II. He served three terms in the Utah legislature, was chairman of the Utah delegation to the White House Conference on Families in 1980. He is a member of the National Executive Committee of the Religious Alliance Against Pornography and has served as a board member of the Vision Cable Network. He and his wife, Marion Bangeter Lindsay, are the parents of six married children. Elder Lindsay has said, "One of the greatest joys of my life is to see the love that my children have for each other." We're very honored to have as our speaker today and to have his lovely companion with him, Elder Richard P. Lindsay.
Brothers and sisters, it's a joy and a blessing to be in this beautiful setting, to be with friends and loved ones, and especially the great students of this Ricks College student body. President Bennion is very kind and very generous in his introduction. Sister Lindsay always says, when I'm introduced in this fashion, it sounds like you're either very old or you can't keep a job. I must confess to both of those. President Bennion did not tell you. He was kind enough to say this in our luncheon meeting preceding this with members of the staff, that we enjoy some common bloodlines. And he may not be proud of his Lindsay lines, but I'm very proud of my Bennion ancestry and am so grateful for his leadership along with Sister Marge Bennion of this great institution. I think you're in a wonderful position to carry forth the great traditions of this place. I was with Elder Ashton in regional meetings in Ogden over the weekend, Sister Lindsay and I, and Elder Ashton told me a story some time ago that might be a little appropriate to this occasion in the spirit of the ties that I share with your distinguished president. He said there was a man, better describes me than your president, who was out of work and was looking for something to do, and he hadn't had anything to eat for several days, and he was very hungry. And he ended up at the zoo, and he went to the zookeeper and said, "Do you have anything here that a man could do to earn a little bit to get something to eat?" And the fellow looked him over, and he didn't present much of an appearance, and he said, "No," he said, "I don't think we've got anything for a fellow like you." And so the man kind of slouched and turned around and started to walk away, and he said, "Just a minute," he says, "come back," he said, maybe there is something you can do. The man felt sorry for him. He said, we've just lost our pet gorilla. And he said, we skinned him out, and if someone would be willing to put that skin on and get in and entertain the children who are going to show up in a few minutes, why, at least I'll be able to get you something to eat. It was a hot day, and the man smelled the gorilla skin, and he wasn't very intrigued by the idea, but he was so hungry, he said, well, I better do it. So he took the skin, and they'd put a zipper in the back, and he put on the gorilla's skin and got inside the cage, and the children came, and he started to get in the spirit of his calling, and he was jumping around and turning his lips up and down like this and scratching himself, and then he got totally carried away with himself, gave a great big swing onto a tree in the cage, went up and grabbed a higher branch. Unfortunately, it was an old branch, and it broke. And he fell to the bottom over the side of the next cage, which was the lion's den. And he was lying on his back. And to the loudest that he could yell, he said, help, help. And the lion said, quiet, you fool, or we'll both be out of a job. That was not the theme that I had for my talk. And President Benyon, excuse me, please. Sister Lindsay and I are parents of 20 grandchildren. We have some brand new twin granddaughters. And as I get older, I have the feeling that we have a hard time running to keep up with the youth of your generation. But if we're not able to keep up with them, I hope we at least will be known as those who love the youth and who want to be behind the youth. Marion touched me as we looked over this great group, and she said, do you know that we probably will have grandchildren up here in the very few years? And that helped me maybe think my age a little bit. I don't always act my age. And I would like to speak to you young people today about something that's very close to my heart, and I hope to yours. I want to talk a little bit about learning and faith and goals, and see if I can make those all fit together somehow. Both my generation and yours are separated by about 4 decades or more of living. And we're all searching for answers and trying to discover, anxious to reveal or to learn of new truth. This universal urge is fostered and kept alive by a discontent which abides within all of us. We are all, in other words, on a lifelong quest for truth. We're always pursuing, but never completely arriving. The spirit of adventure, the desire to know, to explore, to discover what's on the other side of the mountain, or the ocean, or in outer space, is an age-old and worldwide movement. But no generation was ever so well equipped or so well prepared to continue this quest as your generation. The searching spirit is part of your inheritance. I would encourage you to keep it alive and active. I hope that when you leave Rick's College, that your souls will still carry a question mark as an indelible brand, that the spirit of intelligent inquiry will continue to gnaw at you as long as life lasts. Some great thinker has said, age is wise, it attempts nothing impossible. Youth, however, is perhaps wiser. It believes nothing is impossible. My appeal to you who are entering upon the journey of life is that you build solidly and confidently upon the foundations laid by your predecessors. Foundations that are deep and broad enough to support whatever genius you might be able to add and build upon. Continue to seek for answers to questions that continue to multiply. In the case of most of you, it would be well to remember that the 2 years that you spent here at Rich College would not have been possible without significant preparation by your parents, and often, in the case of many of you, by great sacrifice. In your relations with your parents, I would ask that your hearts be increasingly turned to each other, to let your words of affection and appreciation touch one another. Remember that their world is pretty challenging as well as your own.
It's also important to remember that while you're still young, that you can decide who you really are as children of God, and what you want to be, and where you want to go, and the price you're willing to pay to get there. It's been more than 30 years ago that I was called to be a relatively young age, just like President Benyon. He was 29 then, and I was 31. I don't mean we were that close in age, but we were called to be bishops at those respective ages. And I was counseled by the leaders of the church when I was called that my greatest responsibility was to provide spiritual guidance and direction to the young people in our ward. In the ensuing years, this age group provided some of the deepest concerns, the greatest heartaches, and some of the most beautiful, satisfying moments I've ever lived. Hundreds of personal interviews and numerous youth trips and countless priesthood scouting and young women programs, scores of meetings where young people spoke of their faith in God and His Son, our Savior, reinforced my faith and confidence in this choice young people of that generation. Notwithstanding this faith and confidence in their generation and yours, I have come to believe in the need for a greater sense of direction by most of the youth of the Lord's church, the need to be motivated to set and achieve appropriate spiritual and temporal goals in life. It hasn't been long ago that I drove onto a major freeway in Salt Lake City. Very often you see young people there with signs indicating a destination that they would like to arrive at and that they would hope that you would pick them up and take them there. As I drove onto that freeway, I believe it was 5th South, the first sign said San Francisco. Maybe 100 yards later, the next one said Los Angeles. And I'll never forget the next sign. It was larger than the other two. It simply said, anywhere. And I thought at the time that that seemed to be symbolic of the dilemma and the frustration of so many young people who lack a sense of direction in their lives and where their destination really ought to be. A thoughtful adult advised me when I was a teenager that the world would get out of the way for a person who really knew where he or she was going. I can vividly recall my 8th grade teacher going down the list of rows of young people in that little pioneer community and asking us as 13-year-olds, what did we really want to be when we grew up and matured? And I remember he asked me, and I said, I wanted to be a farmer and a teacher. And his response was, well, that's probably a good idea, because if you're going to be a teacher, you should have another job to help make a living. And that always made an impression on my mind. But there was another fellow in our class named Wayne. He said, what do you want to be? And he said, I'm going to be a physician. And I can remember we all teetered, because no young person that I could ever remember or a person that had grown up in our community had ever been a doctor. And so we had a good laugh about that. About 30 years later, Sister Lindsay and I met this man in a distant city. You know, of course, what he was doing. He was practicing medicine. And he came from a large family, 13 children, limited resources. And he said something like, if I hadn't had a clear goal in my life, I could never have reached and risen above the obstructions that were in my path. When I was a young bishop, I thought of something, and I thought it was inspired at the time. It was the first Sunday of 1960. We gathered together the young people of our ward. We were a large ward, probably more than 1,000 in the ward at that time. It was the first Sunday of a new decade, just as it was 2 weeks ago. When you think of the 60s, a lot of words pop into your mind. If I ask you, and we took just a few minutes, I think we would hear most of the words that I hear as I mention this to youth groups in the church. We would think of Vietnam. We would think of rebellion. We would think of drugs. Woodstock, the assassination of some of the great leaders in our country, and a time of great turmoil and great frustration. So we ask this group of young people to come together on a Sunday morning. Many years earlier in seminary, I'd learned this little poem. To every man there openeth a way and ways and a way, and the high soul climbs the highway, and the low soul gropes the low. But in between on misty flats the rest drift to and fro. But to every man there openeth a highway and a low, and every man decideth the way his soul shall go. And so in this morning we had what we called our life prediction experiment, and we said to the young people something like this. This is not January 1960, this is January 1970. And you're not 12 to 19 years of age, you're 22 to 29 years of age. And in those intervening 10 years, some of the most important decisions of your life will have been made. And we said this, in 10 years, and I said, we have a little time machine here, and we're turning the calendar forward 10 years. We're all coming back together. And we're going to conduct a little life prediction experiment today. And what are the most important questions that you would like to have answered in your own lives 10 years from now? So every young person was given a sheet of paper and a writing instrument. And by a system of collective discussion and reasoning, we came up with six questions that seemed to be the most vital in the lives of that group. What kind of an education will I receive? What will be my life's work and occupation? Will I be married? And a subset of that was, what kind of marriage will I have? Will I be active in the church and be living the gospel's teachings? Will I fill a mission? And where will I be living? Now, you're a few years older, but if you were going to reconstitute such a list, I would think most of those questions would be on your short list. I've involved other groups and young people in subsequent efforts in other years, and it usually comes down to a list very much like this. After we determined these questions, we emphasized to the young people that within certain obvious limits, many of these critical questions, which bore on their future happiness and accomplishment, were within their own capacity to determine or at least strongly influence the outcome. After we reached consensus on the questions of greatest concern, each person was then asked to write down his own answer and prediction to each question. We promised the youth that their answers would be completely confidential and known only to themselves. Their answers were then placed in a sealed envelope. I agreed to maintain that envelope for the next 10 years in a confidential file. And as adult leaders of that ward, we made a pact with the young people in that January 1960 meeting for the follow-up part of that experiment to take place in January 1970. As a bishopric, and we were young enough then, and we were brave enough to say that, I don't know if I'd be able to make that same offer at my stage of life, but we were young and we were looking forward to the next 10 years. And we said that if we're still here, we'll get back together. And we pledged our wives. It's always easier to pledge your wife to do something, to cook a turkey dinner. And we'll see you in 10 years. Well, those 10 years went by in a hurry. The decade of the turbulent 1960s rolled on. Life was full of change and adjustment for those young people as well as those of us that were a little older. Most of the young men in that group completed successful missions in that 10-year period, and a majority by 1970 had married, and most of them were parents in their own right. Most of them were well along with their education and their careers or their professions or their trades. Parenthetically, I might add, as I look over this congregation, that the older members of that group are now 50 years of age, and some of them may be your parents. That's a frightening thought, isn't it? Sister Lindsay, to think that that's the age of this group that we conducted this experiment with. I don't mean to overemphasize the importance of that one effort on the ultimate impact of what became of this great choice group of young people. I know that there are many other influences at work besides setting goals and doing something of this type. Certainly the greatest influence was probably within the walls of their own home. But it gave us an opportunity to visit and say, you know, how are you coming with your personal goals? And it helped the self-assessment process among those young people. During those next 10 years, we emphasized the need for those youth to set short and intermediate range goals. In that same class in the 8th grade, there was one young boy, when the teacher asked him what he wanted to be, he said, "I want to be an aeronautical engineer." And that was pretty impressive in 1938. We didn't have a lot of aeronautical engineers. And the teacher said, "What's that?" And the young fellow said, "I don't know. I just know I want to be one." But I think it was a case where the goal was not supported by the relationship of short-term objectives. I think that's hard for many of us to comprehend. If you want to be a medical doctor, you've got to pay the price. If you want to be a missionary, you have to pay the price. If you want to be married in the Lord's house for time and all eternity, you have to pay the price. And yet, this next 10 years passed miraculously fast. For those of us that were the adult leaders in 1960, as that date approached, we sought out the names and addresses as best we could find them of all the members in that original group. And Sister Lindsay is my witness to say that we fulfilled on our promise. We called the young folks who are now adults back together in the old ward chapel. We had the turkey dinner. Everyone was given back his own envelope. Everyone opened his own envelope. Some of them wanted to share the things that they'd said. In some cases, they thought what they'd said had been quite immature and quite silly. But I remember there was one young mother there. Her husband was in Southeast Asia in the military. Vietnam War was still going on. She was the mother of two beautiful sons. Now she's the mother of seven sons and the wife of a former bishop. This dinner proceeded with great warmth and fellowship, and many of those attending had not seen each other for many years. Spirited tales of remember when brought nostalgic memories of these earlier youthful associations and choice experiences. Personal testimonies emphasized the importance and blessings of the gospel in their lives. These young people that were now grown to maturity and had families of their own. And so the envelopes were open. Some were not there. For a few, it would not have been a comfortable association. Their own lifestyle and their own circumstances had changed so that for a handful, there were those who would not feel comfortable in that group and who did not attend. And I think I still have somewhere stored away the individual envelopes of those persons who did not show up to that 1970 meeting. It'd be a happy ending if I could say that all of them were there and had achieved at least the short-term goals that they had set for themselves. Just be grateful, young brothers and sisters, to parents and leaders and this great faculty and staff of this institution who love you and are trying to lead you. I'm impressed with how many of these great faculty and staff of this university hold major other responsibilities in the church. Be grateful for those that are trying to lead you to higher ground. And above all, remember what Paul said to the Corinthians. Sister Lindsay and I have lived long enough to know that God keeps his promises. And this is what Paul said, "Eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for them that love him." Your generation possesses powers conferred by science to wreck or rebuild the world. And the degree to which those of your generation carry faith in God and in your fellow men and in yourselves will determine whether these tremendous forces will be used to build a better world or be responsible for its destruction. In spite of these sobering challenges, may I suggest the need for a sense of humor. The distinguished father of your esteemed President Benyon once advised a son of mine, as he set forth on a mission halfway around the world, instead of profound and erudite counsel at that time, he simply said, "Gordon, just remember to laugh a little bit every day. A sense of humor may help preserve your sanity during your college days as you contend with the often strange behavior of your professors. You will need it again when you marry and are continually mystified by the mysteries of the opposite sex." Some of us have been involved in that for 40 years or more. Abraham Lincoln is reported to have said, "If I could not tell or hear a good story occasionally, I think I'd go crazy. It is like oxygen to my soul." And J. Golden Kimball on one occasion said, "I think God himself must like a joke. If he hadn't, he wouldn't have made some of you people." Now, I don't apply that to this group today. I don't want to be accused of that. I hope that you'll leave Rick's College with a greater appreciation and an appetite for good books. Comparatively few American adults now read out of the best books. Instead, indiscriminate watching of television has become the national pastime. For the last several years, as President Benyon has said, before I received this calling, I was the director of public communications for the church, as he's indicated. In this role, I came to know somewhat of the overwhelming influence of the media, and especially television, in these days in shaping our thoughts and our values and our lifestyle. Let me share with you just a few figures which may be familiar to some of you, but which I believe will help us to better understand the urgency of the challenge that I'm talking about. In 1987, the average American home had TV on an average of 7 hours and 7 minutes every day. The average viewer watched about 4 hours and 30 minutes each day, or 31 and a half hours each week, almost 19% of our waking and sleeping time. By the time today's young people graduate from high school, they will have logged 16,000 hours of television, including 50,000 commercials, more than all the hours spent in the classroom combined. There are studies that indicate that children who are heavy viewers do worse in school than light viewers, that watching television often depresses reading skills, restricts an expansion in language skills, and often reinforces violent behavior. Last year, I asked our public communication staff to survey a typical day in the life of network television. They recorded 12 hours of programming on CBS for one day, and it would be similar to the other national broadcasting stations. We arbitrarily chose CBS. For that one day, there were 84 scenes of violence, including 43 of mindless destruction of property, 25 of physical abuse, 1 of murder, which would be low for most days, 15 of verbal abuse, 86 scenes involving suggestive sexual material, 9 involving adultery or premarital sex, 40 including extremely immodest dress, innuendo or suggestive or vulgar jokes, 1 rape, and 36 where suggestive, rather blatant sexual material was used in advertising, 45 scenes involving offensive profanity. If you project these totals for one day, in a year, there would be 21,840 scenes of violence, more than 22,000 of sexual explicit scenes, and 11,700 of the uses of profanity. Most heavy TV viewers express a greater sense of insecurity and apprehension about their world. The average child will have viewed 150,000 violent episodes, including an estimated 25,000 deaths on television by the time he or she graduates from high school. Unfortunately, heavy watchers of television often tend to become spectators at almost everything else, and this country doesn't need and cannot flourish with citizens who are spectators. For some of you, this year at Rick's College may be the end of your formal education. For still others of you, it will be a finish line, which is also a starting line, marking the end of lower division work and the beginning of upper division work on another campus. I would encourage you to think in terms of additional formal education. It's that kind of a world in which we live. So much of your later life will depend upon the thoroughness
with which you are educated and prepared now. Don't sell yourselves short in what you can accomplish academically. Later on in life, others of you, because of changing circumstances and stirrings and yearnings, will resume your formal education. I can speak from a certain amount of first-hand experience on that subject. As one who spent 20 years in some form of college-related training, some people said you just weren't very smart, and the only way I was able to get a doctor's degree was to be as old as many of my professors. And I don't commend that to you, but I do say, hang in there. I can attest to the enrichment which that odyssey and that experience offered me in my life, in the life of my family. My own formal education taught me how much I did not yet know, and likewise how subdivided and specialized knowledge is. A pretty good argument for continuing your education. And don't pay attention to the pessimists who predict our downfall. Avoid extremism and hysteria in all its forms, and be guided by cool, even-headed common sense. I've known a lot of educated people that weren't very substantial and didn't have very much common sense. Somebody told the story of a man who hadn't had a lot of education, but he made a lot of money, and somebody asked him how he was able to make all that money without an education. And he said, I just designed this little kind of a widget that we make, and I got all these fellows together and we make them. And he said, it cost me about $2 to make them, and I sell them for $5. And he says, over time, that 3% really adds up. I might have to try that again on some of you math majors. Real and worthwhile and usable education teaches us the dignity of honest labor and should make it possible for each of us to find and do the work for which he or she is best fitted. And it convinces us that all knowledge is hurtful if it does not have goodness. The truly educated person is receptive to new ideas, is free from prejudice, and has the ability to distinguish between appearance and reality. I like the lines from the poet Emerson, who said, "It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who in the midst of a crowd keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude." Your education here at RIC should help enable you to apply cultivated minds to the problems of living. It should provide trained judgment and make for discrimination, freedom, and tolerance to understand the point of view of others, and extend the freedom which one demands for his own ideas. This should help you to live with your fellow men in harmony and cooperate in promoting goodwill. Upon the truly educated people of our country depends the progress of civilization. One great gift of education is that it gives us the ambition to dream, to do, to become, each according to his own talents. It gives us the will to continue in the struggle, no matter how great the odds are against us. We must care enough about the future of the world never to be satisfied with the present. Most of you will be blessed to be parents. All of you will be neighbors. All of you will be citizens, whether in Rexburg or Richfield or Riverside or Rochester. For the great majority of you, the most important work you will ever do will be within the walls of your own homes. And I wouldn't promise you an easy life. I hope you don't have one. I wouldn't secure it for you if I could. For one's life is similar to the life of a tree whose roots are driven down in the solid earth by the winds and the storms, which either strengthen the tree or destroy it. As the poet said, good timber does not grow in ease. The stronger the wind, the stronger the trees. The farther the sky, the greater the length. The more the storm, the more the strength. By sun and cold, by rain and snow, in tree or man, good timbers grow. You'll need determination, endurance, and self-discipline, knowledge and love of God and fellow men if you're going to make it successfully through this life. With it all, you must muster the courage at certain times when there is nothing in you except that which says, hold on. And finally, if you are to enjoy this great journey of life to its fullest. I would prayerfully admonish you to seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all else will be added unto you. I've lived long enough, brothers and sisters, to know the truth of this divine principle. God keeps His promises. Of this I humbly testify to you and extend my love and greeting and the appreciation of the general authorities of the church for your goodness, for your sincerity, and the great core of leaders of this institution. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.